I think we're going to go ahead and get started. Thank you for coming to the ARSC technical, one of the technical committee presentations. I am not Mike Casey. He has hair and it's not gray. Unfortunately, he can't be here today, so I'm the stand-in moderator. And we're going to be talking about the topic of outsourcing audio preservation work. We've got two great folks here to give you a presentation. To my right is David Seward. Most of you are familiar with David as he's curated the Performing Arts Collection at UC Santa Barbara since 1998. He also manages the audiovisual archives and recorded sound collections. He's project director of the Cylinder Preservation and Digitization Program, which was a groundbreaking effort, I think, in putting a lot of Cylinder recordings and making them available on the web. He has degrees from Oberlin and Library and Information Studies from the University of Wisconsin. David has taught courses in audio video archives management at the University of Wisconsin in Madison and consulted on audio preservation issues for various organizations. He served on the board for the ARSC for 8 years and is currently the past president. Mr. Blood, well, means his term is ending. I really, this guy's gonna give me grief for the entire presentation, so I'll be sure and give it back for his bio. Next to David is George Blood. George has, I'm sure most of you are very familiar with his company, formerly Safe Sound Archives, now George Blood Audio and Video LP. And since 1982, he has recorded over 4,000 live events. He's recorded or produced over 200 CDs, three of which have been nominated for Grammys. His company was founded in 1992. And to this day, it continues as a repository for the thousands of recordings that Mr. Blood has accumulated. And it houses the recital archives of the Curtis Institute of Music, as well as the concert recordings of the Philadelphia Orchestra. George's company produces or digitizes approximately 1,000 hours of audio and video per month. So he certainly has an understanding of a high throughput and QC and the things that are involved with respect to that. He's an active teacher and presenter at conferences and has a long laundry list of papers that he's presented and panels that he has been a part of. And he's an active teacher and presenter. And he and his wife have, I think, 37 children. And I think we're going on about 250 plus grandchildren. No, he has four daughters and one son. And so with that, I will turn it over to David and George, and then what we want to make sure is that they get through their presentation and that we make sure we have plenty of time left open for Q&A. And so I'll be moderating that part, but for now, I'm gonna hand it over to David and George. Thanks.
Thank you, John. This might be a little unconventional for a technical committee presentation, since the presentation is not technical. It's really about project management more than anything. And we're going to do it in such a way that we're going to try to give the perspective from both sides of managing a project. Internal project management is one thing, where you have your own staff that you're working with, managing your own resources and workflows and things like that. The picture changes when you're working with a vendor, and that's what we're really gonna go into here today, is how that process hopefully should work. And this presentation is actually based on a presentation that George and Alan Lewis have given before. So in a way, I'm stepping in for Alan Lewis here, and I'm playing the part of the the institution that's looking to contract for services, and George is then playing the part of the vendor who has to respond to that proposal, actually perform the work and things like that. We're going to try to, we've got till, John, it's till 3:15, so we've got just an hour and 15 minutes now. What we're going to try to do is spend about somewhere in the neighborhood of an hour, George and I, doing our presentation, and then we want to leave plenty of time for roundtable question and answer, things like that. And we have a couple of other vendors in the room, too, who can come up at that point, and we'll allow sort of open discussion of issues and things like that. But without further ado, let us begin. And your battery's probably died, right? Oh, there we go. So what we're talking here today is selecting and managing audio reformatting services. And we have talking about the processes and procedures needed to organize purchase media reproduction work. Hold on a sec while I get the hang of this clicker. Do you have a different clicker? There we go. And that's your cue.
Oh, and some observations from across the table.
So you'll notice the organization is that he's Mr. Italics and I'm regular type.
All right. You didn't know that before.
So when we're putting together a proposal for reformatting services, we have several goals. Great. Our goals here are fourfold. We want a win-win situation for all. The client, me, gets the work done at a high quality and a fair price. The vendor gets a fair price, including profit, and providing that high quality work, and both parties find mutual respect, a cooperative spirit, and institutional harmony along the way.
And I have my own microphone. And our cultural heritage is preserved for future generations. This is what it's all about.
So we have four parts of the presentation here. We're going to be talking about the procurement process. The second section is really about the RFP, the request for proposal, or the statement of work. They're different, but they're interconnected. The third part is about selecting your vendor, and the fourth part is managing the project. By the time we get through this first part, you're going to have forgotten that there was going to be a second part, so do sort of keep in mind this overarching thing that we have four sort of big sections here. The first step of your process is you have to identify the need and its place within the institution's overall priorities.
You know, is this part of a larger project, or is it just year-end money? That kind of information is very useful to a vendor because we'll know how it fits into the bigger picture and how urgent the project is, where it needs to be queued.
Do you need to justify the project to a higher authority, secure funds, and get the okay to proceed? We all have more projects than we can do, and their feasibility is largely dependent on things like this, most often money. So that's the first thing you have to get out of the way.
And it matters a lot at the time of RFP to know whether it's a current or future project. So if you're just looking for information to put into a proposal, or do you have a line item that this work will proceed right away? And it is okay to contact a vendor with a prospective proposal and just try to get it, well, how much would it cost to do something like this to begin the discussions? But to push that information out front, because if you're kicking tires, then that's a cue to us that, one, it could take a while for this to come around, and you're new to this, and the amount of information that we push out and help you to understand the process is greater for something like that.
And I kick tires all the time. I've talked to vendors more about projects that never happened than about projects that did happen. But I'm up front with them. I say, hey, I'm kicking the tires, George, or whoever, and then we go from there, and I can get a ballpark of, you know, order of magnitude and scale and things like that. The next step would be to prepare a thorough and fully detailed project description.
This is particularly with regards to AV materials, can be a very dicey thing, because for a lot of institutions, this will be the first time that they're handling this. And even though you'll be maybe very well qualified and familiar with the field, and AV may be well within your intellectual capacity. It may still be new, and the vendors will sit together over dinner and trade tales about spectacularly poorly written requests for proposals that are clearly just reworked from something else. So be careful when you're putting this stuff out to be true to yourself about what the level of expertise that you have, so that you present an honest face to the vendors.
I think that's important because, you know, when working with auto mechanics, everybody's sort of embarrassed that if you admit that you don't know how the transmission works, they're going to rip you off. I think we have to approach these relationships in a different frame of light. The reason we're contracting with vendors is because we don't always have that expertise. So don't feel like if you don't understand azimuth that you should pretend that you do or something like that. Just ask questions. Continuing in the process, identify vendors who can provide the required service. There's several ways to do this. Things like the ARS conference, for one, are a great way to meet vendors. Use leads from colleagues. Check ads in the professional literature and trade press. I noticed in the program there's ads for vendors as well. Exhibitors at trade shows like this. And consider vendors who speak at professional meetings.
This is can be a sore point for any vendor in any area about whether you have a specific vendor in mind and you just need to get additional quotes. Why are you collecting these proposals? Different institutions have different requirements, and it helps to just be upfront. It creates a lot of goodwill. And there are lots of lists available for AV materials. We've listed a couple here. You know, ARSC maintains a list on their website. NEDCC has a list. Just do a little bit of due diligence, like David mentioned, about looking at conference listings and exhibitors. A little bit of effort. You'd be surprised at how many AV vendors there are out there.
And do then a market survey to get a sense of the cost and maybe more options involved.
I think you're going to find this generally pretty difficult to do because it's not like you can sit down with half a dozen office supply catalogs and compare. There's a lot of differences in the way that the vendors price their services, so doing apples for apples comparison can be a bit of a struggle. And there's generally not a lot of transparency in the marketplace. So compared to office supplies and looking at catalogs, you know, there aren't a lot of published price lists for these kinds of services.
That's a theme we're going to be coming back to in almost every aspect of this presentation, is that reformatting services are not a commodity. There are services that are a commodity and that you can expect sort of fixed prices and interchangeabilities between vendors of such services, whether that's getting a will done or getting something like that. I think those assumptions really don't hold true here, and so always keep in mind that we're not dealing with commodity services here. Then you need to get the whole purchasing process organized and staffed within your own institution, including who and how the vendor response will be evaluated, their ability to provide the service, and their costs. And here we're really talking about the purchasing and contracting portion of the process.
This is something that David and I have struggled with a bit when we were putting this presentation together, because this step varies widely from institution to institution. As a vendor, we see everything from government agencies all the way down to small historical societies. So some institutions have a great deal of bureaucracy behind their purchasing, very strict rules about above such and such a threshold, things have to go to bid and so on. So just knowing a little bit about your own process and being able to convey that is very useful. But also be careful of this, be sympathetic to the soft costs, where you send out repeated changes of requests. We've had one regular client where we'll issue an RFP 3 or 4 or 5 times. Oh, we found one more tape. Well, it still have to rewrite the documents. We had one major university sent out an RFI. It took us 60 hours to reply to the first round. We were comforted that the second round only took 35 hours. And when it was awarded, it proved to be only a $10,000 job. There's an awful amount of work that goes into this. So anybody who sat through writing out a grant proposal and thought how laborious that is, that's, for a vendor, that's the rough equivalent.
part of this is you're building a relationship with a vendor, hopefully a relationship that leads to repeat business. And you really have to be sympathetic to, you know, every time you send out an RFP or something like that, that it does take them a considerable amount of time to reply. And if you don't have your information gathered ahead of time, you know, vendors can develop bad reputations, but institutions can develop bad reputations as well.
It costs me approximately between $400 and $500 on average to reply to an RFP. Some of them require, you know, weeks of work, and some of them you can put together in an hour, but it's running about $400 or $500 on average to reply to a request for a bid of any size.
The next step would be to write the request for proposal and or the statement of work, which we'll refer to as the SOW, and more on this shortly. Remember, that is the second part of this presentation. This process varies widely as well. In many cases, George will write the statement of work, but there are, particularly in government institutions and things like that, the statement of work will be part of that initial set of documents that goes out to the vendor.
This is still part of yours.
Oh, I'm sorry. That is
part of that.
Consider a cost line item for routine media preparation and straight reproduction work. Consider a line item for the vendor's application of labor, time, and materials to provide heroic measures. That would be fixing tapes that are, broken, mold treatment, baking, things like that. Consider a cost line item for payment to cover labor, time, and materials for unable to reproduce items. I guess that would be the same thing, right?
No, it's two different things. The middle one is when you have things that are severely deteriorated and are going to require a lot more effort. The last one is, what if the tape is blank? You know, we have to prepare the tape, organize it, handle it, put it on a machine. Do you get charged for that? Is it fair to be charged for a blank tape?
Absolutely.
We'll run the entire length of the tape to be sure that it's completely blank. That's not to say that it has to take a lot of time, but although you may end up with nothing, we still spend time on it.
But if the institution says, well, why am I paying $200 for him to transfer a blank tape? That may be more of a miscommunication of expectations more than anything else. And I know that, you know, institutional budgets are tight or everything like that, but it did take them real time, and that vendor was paying for them. So make sure all those, you know, the communication is such that you know exactly how those situations are going to be dealt with in advance, and that the bill doesn't come and you're unexpectedly paying for things you didn't anticipate.
We find the standardized response sheet often the most poorly designed part of the RFP. It's a nice effort, but it often reflects the limit of knowledge, particularly on the part of purchasing agents, to try to put something like this together. And also, we find it to be restrictive in terms of being creative in the reply to the request that may be vague in very many ways, like how long, what duration are things, what assumptions are being made about that. For instance, in this particular list of bullets, in the way that my pricing is built out, I assume that a certain amount of the stuff is going to require handling. And we have a certain percentage, which is called out in a footnote about how to do this. But if it's called out as a second line item, then I have to reverse engineer that out of my pricing to break it out. So these kinds of standardized price lists can be a two-edged sword in terms of whether it really gives you the information that you want. Again, as David was saying, these aren't commodities, and everybody finds different ways of solving these problems.
And if necessary, publish the solicitation with its RFP or statement of work in accordance with institutional policies, procedures, and channels, and to potential vendors you know who may not be reached by those regular channels. This, again, applies differently to different institutions. You may be able to issue a purchase order to whatever vendor you want up to a certain dollar amount. You may have to go through competitive bidding. Your contracting office may actually have to issue it. But find this out, because it could vary widely, and you could have one set of expectations for how you're going to contract with this particular vendor, and you may not end up actually being able to do that because of certain institutional requirements for bids on contracts of a certain value and that sort of thing.
There are any number of Well, you know, just, well, as I say here, in general, sunshine is the best disinfectant. I don't know that I've dealt with another vendor in AV who wasn't really open in their in the process. One thing that I enjoy in my work is that there's a high degree of collegiality among the AV vendors. We understand that the role that we play in preserving the sound of history and keeping these materials available going forward. So we're keeping the process open is something that we all appreciate. And again, this is something that within will vary very widely within institutions. And we did a $25,000 project once for an institution that had a $2,500 threshold. Anything above $2,500 had to go to bid. So I just submitted a whole lot of $2,499 invoices, and it flew right through. You know, it was year-end money. It was like it was gonna go away. But you know, it's just that, you know, being really upfront about, you know, if you work in a large institution, you know, there's somebody in purchasing or the secretary in the department who just knows how to make things happen. It's because they understand the spirit of why those rules are in place. I always love dealing with the city of Boston because it's clear a whole lot of people have gone to jail there. Their process is extremely clearly defined and really a pain in the ass. But you know, you understand where those rules come from.
And then receive your responses up to the deadline date, if there is a deadline date, and follow institutional response procedures for late responses. And that really applies mostly to competitively bid things where there will be a deadline and procedures for how to deal with bids that come in after that deadline.
And be sure to acknowledge that. It's really frustrating. Anybody who's been applying for jobs lately and not getting even an acknowledgement of the receipt of their resume can appreciate how you send things in and you don't even know that it has arrived. And one of my favorite lines in an RFP is, it'll say, you know, you should expect to hear by such and such a date, but we reserve the right to move that. Or, you know, so the vendor's being held to a deadline, but the institution's not.
In a timely fashion, evaluate the response for their technical merit. That should be obvious, but timely is works differently in for-profit corporations and often government and academia.
And since this is likely to be something new to you, or there's such a variety, expect there to be some variation. I know when we contract for services, particularly large services, like when we were building our studio, I couldn't believe the range of what the pricing was. And so I just called the vendors and said, you know, why is this so, why is your price 20% higher than somebody else's? And it's not, well, we're just busy, we don't want the job, that could be a legitimate one, or they misread or interpret, you know, this is gonna be really hard. So since there is, it's like, it's not a commodity, have that dialogue with the vendors and provide for that. What this area of the presentation is going to is that in some situations, you'll have separate evaluation for the technical merits and the pricing. It's not just what's it cost. There's a way to separate that out, but at this in the technical side, I think there's room to have that dialogue.
Part two of that, there's evaluating the project for its technical merits. Can they do what you're requesting them to do? And the second part of that is evaluate the responses for their costs.
That's what I was doing, more of what I was just saying. If there's a real outlier one side, one way or the other, never ceases to marvel me that we'll lose a job because somebody bid half what we did. I wonder how they can do it, or that we would win a job because somebody was twice as expensive as we are. You know, if I saw those numbers in front of me, I'd be on the phone and try to figure out why this discrepancy was there, why it's so what varies so widely. We had one of these was it yesterday. You know, our bid on the job was $87,000, and the winning bid was $17,000. What's wrong with this picture?
Somebody may have misunderstood. Next step, in a timely fashion, combine the findings of the technical merit of the vendor's response and acceptable cost to determine the best value for your institution. Note that best value may not be the lowest bid price. And here we go again, reformatting services are not a commodity.
And keep, you know, in the interest of sunshine being the best disinfectant, keep the vendors informed of the process. I'm sure you've all felt this process where I'm sure they're talking to somebody else and holding us out. Why aren't they talking to us? What's going on? And it's also really important to know whether it's going to be lowest price or best value. For as highfalutin as a lot of the talk can be around AV services, it's amazing how often it'll be price driven when it comes time to actually doing the work. And the idea that you would go through multiple stages and shortlist vendors, this happens all the time in commercial settings, that you qualify vendors, you pass people to a second stage where they may have a chance to refine their bids based on whatever discussion.
Then finally, you get to award the contract and begin work.
And there's a whole lot of preparation we find that goes between the award and the starting of the work, even knowing who gets the invoice and where things are going to be shipped and what method you want to ship it, and is it your FedEx account number or ours? A bit of a lag time that can happen in there. It's just part of that dialogue of just getting a relationship set up. And you also want to be mindful of what your timeline is. A good vendor's likely to have a very long deadline. And we've had any number of sometimes very large projects that are grant funded, and you get 12 months to do a $200,000 job and it arrives at your doorstep at month 11. These are things where you want to, we're not quite ready to send it to you, but our deadline is shipped, moved, but yours hasn't. Just keep that dialogue going so that the process runs smoothly. If it ends up rushed, that's bad for everybody.
And George and I were talking about that this morning, where as a private entity, if he realizes there's a gap in his system where he needs additional people to do quality control or whatever, he can go out and hire people. If I suddenly realize that I've contracted for some sort of service and I don't have the people to prepare the metadata in order to move these things out the door and provide him with the necessary metadata, I may be just stuck. And that's why a lot of times why these projects be like, he'll get the stuff on month 11, is because we thought we could ship it out January 1st, but we had to scramble to get together the necessary people in our institution to get those other preliminary things done.
We had tapes come in and then wait 2 months for the metadata to come in. We've had the tapes for 2 months. Yeah, but we didn't have everything started.
Ignore those two slides. The next step, so this is meta concept two, which is the request for proposal, the RFP, and the statement of work, the SOW. The success of the project hinges on well-thought-out and well-written RFP and statement of work. These are documents that crystallize your thinking, enable vendors to accurately bid on the work, and provide a means by which you evaluate how well the vendor is doing the work.
We normally expect the RFP to be verbose and narrative, but the SOP should be extremely brief, and if anything, maybe just a set of bullets that is very specific.
Repeat or possibly expand the project goal statement that was used earlier in process step three, which was the project description.
And we generally like to be the ones who generate the statement of work, so that the institution generates the request for proposal and then we write the specifications. And we like that symmetry, that if you can read my document and I've read your document, that's a way of being sure that we've understood each other in the communications.
And that'll vary from institution. Some institutions will issue both an RFP and a statement of work, and some will do that. I write the RFP, he writes a statement of work, and if they look the same, then we know that we've communicated correctly. So you just will have to deal with whatever the process is at your own institution.
One of the things we like to include in a statement of work is exclusions. And that's not to say that we're not doing that, but it can say, like, who's paying for the shipping, or that it doesn't include and this. So it's a way of just being clarifying by exclusion.
And here's where we're getting to sort of the technical part of the technical committee presentation. In your writing your RFP or your statement of work, you do need to describe your technical specifications, and you need to describe in great detail the source documents that are to be copied, ages, quantities, sizes, formats, shapes, speeds, diameters, packaging, physical condition, known problems, virtually in everything and everything you know or speculate about the materials. But be careful that you don't sort of over-describe unnecessary things. I mean, the size of an object may provide a clue to its content, its length, its format, or whatever, but it may be totally pointless. You know, George knows what a cassette tape is. You don't need to say anything other than it's a cassette tape. So,
if your materials are all on 10-inch reels, but the reels are only half full, that's relevant information. And the information that you're sending to the vendor, we really think it should be described at the item level, whether that's for a packing list to be sure that we're talking about the same things, or if it's just how the metadata is being organized. If you haven't done it before, I don't think there's a vendor out there who doesn't have some existing system for doing this. It'd have a form that you can fill out. And the flip side is we can almost always deal with something that you already have in a database or an asset management system. And it's also, some of the information here can be extremely relevant. It matters a lot to us whether you just need a title, artist, and date, or you're going to be looking for 100 fields of complex metadata.
And that's going to affect your price. And always remember that the more you ask for, the more expensive it gets.
It's all possible. We had a project that we did entailing some very complex metadata in very poorly organized source material, all standards-based, using AS57 and Dublin Core and some premise in there, and AS31 380Ls. And we have I think we set a new world record. We have a database or a METS record for an AV interview that runs 70,000 lines. It's all possible.
Describe in detail the vendor's deliverables and the end products to be created.
Include the vendor in the process of those descriptions. This is almost certainly more familiar to us than it is to you. The work we've done with David over the years has been a lot of fun because David is, as a client, extremely well-versed and also is ready to say, I don't know. But that's unusual. Most institutions we're dealing with, this is all new to them. But even something as simple as a folder nest is something that you want to define ahead of time. It may be very easy to put things in the right folders and a real pain in the butt to move it to a different organization.
Mm-hmm. Define the mechanics of the project as you wish them to be. Batching of source documents, shipping methods to be used, timelines and deadlines, billing frequency, billing details, whole host of things like that.
Again, include the vendor in these discussions. We have a lot of experience in these things. And one of the things that we encounter most frequently is our processing volume substantially exceeds what most institutions can do to ingest. So you may want it as fast as we can do it and then find that shipping more than 200 or 300 items a month exceeds your ability to ingest that. So lean on the vendors for their experience in these areas.
Who institutions have projects that you've got hard drives sitting on your desk waiting to ingest them? Raise your hand. Yeah, there you go. Right the back, Catlin. I mean, it's just a fact and that they'll probably get the stuff back to you faster than you can do all the follow-up work and process it and get in your mass storage system and that sort of thing.
And until you finish it, you're going to hold up our payment on our invoice? It's not because we didn't deliver on a timely basis, but you weren't able to review it.
Because you don't want to pay that bill until you've actually done your own, you know, QC at the end of the process. But sometimes it's just literally not possible. The staff aren't there. You don't have time. Things like that. So, be realistic about that sort of thing.
Keeping in mind that all of my expenses, all of my vendors, all my staff will have been paid by the time you receive the invoice.
Describe to the vendor what else you might supply in addition to the source documents. Source documents meaning the tapes or whatever, but do you have, you know, spreadsheets? Can you provide online access to your Mavis database or whatever, that sort of thing?
Is it to be rehoused? Are you providing the materials or are we providing the materials? Right. If it's going on hard drive, are you gonna provide the drives or are we right on down the line?
Right, I mean, we've had slotless reels drop shipped to George, and we never saw him, but things got spun onto new reels at the time of the transfer.
There was a time when reformatting was done, like quarter inch reel to reel, or video projects going to DigiBait, and institutions would want to bulk buy that and send it to us. And at that point, I'm not responsible for the quality of that media. But if you're buying it through us, then you know we're responsible for it end to end. So there's going to be false economies, not to mention just handling. We have a warehouse full of, that institution's rehousing materials and right on down the line. A lot of overhead with that.
I've done it both ways where I'm like, oh God, that media charge is so expensive. I can't believe how, and then you think, and then when you realize that they won't guarantee the media, but they will guarantee the media they supply. My opinion, it's not worth it to take advantage of any sort of bulk purchasing discounts you can get from buying your own media and supplying it. And the vendors can probably get the same sort of discounts or better than you can. The next step in the statement of work, require the vendor to describe its corporate qualifications to do this specific work. Identify by name and qualifications the staff members who will conduct the various functions.
This also extends to the qualifications on both for both parties. We had a project, it was $3,000, and the person had never done an AV project before. We logged 50 hours of staff time teaching that person some really rudimentary things. We've literally been on the phone teaching people to copy and paste in Excel. So what are the qualifications of the party on the other side? We've had contracts that say that state right up front, if we're not happy with our point of contact or who's running it, then the institution reserves the right to tell us to change the personnel. So I have written into the contract the same thing. If I don't like your project manager and they're holding this up, I won't have the right to say the same thing. We went about half the time on that one. But it's also...
But you don't want to get in that situation.
Yeah, so
make sure that you've got, if you need metadata people, if you need IT people, make sure, and you may not directly supervise any of those people either, but make sure you've gone through your chain of command to make sure that when, whatever that IT person needs to do, that they understand that that's, at least for this project, is part of their job responsibilities or something like that.
And it should be very easy to get the resumes of the key personnel who are going to be involved in the project. So you should be able to read those and make sense of them.
Then require a detailed description of how the vendor will assure the quality of the final product.
In many ways, this is something that institutions struggle on. We can't play back the original material. How do we know that you have done your best job on it? We don't have any way of comparing that. There's a lot of checks and balances. We work very very hard with QA and work with institutions on this. And so we have thought through this process. So engage us in that. And all good vendors are going to be doing some QA because the last thing you want to do is be dealing with returns. And there's a really big gap between saying, we stand behind our work 100% and, we'll fix whatever you find if you discover it within the warranty period. But if you're doing a 2, 3, or 10,000-hour project, you're not going to be able to listen to all that stuff straight through. There's got to be some better processes upstream for that.
Yeah, and if you're selecting a vendor, if you're doing a transfer of one priceless object, you may pick a vendor based on their special snake oil that they have, or their magical electronics, or their voodoo, or whatever like that. But if you're doing any sort of quantity of materials, I'm more concerned about the vendor's quality assurance part of their operation than I am about whether they have Nakamichi machines or TIAC machines. I actually don't particularly care about that first part. It's really the quality assurance part is where you're going to end up getting a value project or not.
And quality control, absolutely positively. The faster it can happen, the better, because the QA is not about the last step of the process to be sure that everything got done right. A good QA finds a problem and then goes and searches the source of that problem. And you may find that we've had many cases where the problem turns out to be a bad copy and paste in an Excel spreadsheet that was sent to us. So the metadata is bad, but that it arrived that way. Well, in the meantime, we've processed several hundred more items before you can discover that the stuff, the information that you sent to us, or that you find that, oh, this particular flavor of a hinted MP4 in a MOV wrapper doesn't work with our web server. You know, these are important things to be testing so that there's not rework of materials that haven't shipped.
Next is to describe the requirements of how the new work products are to be packaged. And that, again, is your deliverables, making sure that you've specified that clearly.
Do you want to get everything in the originals back all at once? Do you want to separate them and just ship them in rotation? These are all valid ways of slicing and dicing the problem.
And I would just talk to your vendor about that. They've probably done it more than you have, and they can recommend best practices of when and how to ship, things like that. Describe how the new work products are to be labeled or otherwise identified.
This has gotten a little easier for file naming conventions, but even how you want your graphics laid out on the jewel boxes. Sometimes there are very strict requirements for how shipping boxes are labeled.
And then describe how you would require the vendor to handle and ship your media and or data.
You know all the things you can reasonably anticipate, whether it's ground or overnight. One of the things that we like to not do is ship in a way that would leave a product, or much less originals, on a dock or in a warehouse over a weekend. So we don't do very many shipments on Thursday and Friday. Just simple thinking through of problems like that. And other things, I don't care if the CDs are going to ship over a weekend. They'll survive that nicely, but your source materials shouldn't be.
Yeah, and pay for the things that matter, and don't pay for the other things. You know, when I ship originals, they always go FedEx, and they go on Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday. But if somebody's shipping, you know, derivative CDs back or hard drives or whatever, that stuff can all be replaced. You can ship it however you want, because the vendor's not going to erase the files from the drives until the materials are returned safely. I require a list of equipment to be used during playback of your source documents and statement of how the equipment will be maintained during the duration of the project. And I would say a lot of that goes on vendor reputation for who knows equipment inside and out, who maintains it, things like that.
You know, the project is large enough, put somebody on a plane. It's amazing what you can tell from a site visit. What documentation can the vendor provide? Anybody can say they drive a Lamborghini, right? But the site visits are extremely informative and a lot of fun.
Require the vendor to describe the physical security, fire, and water protection at its work site.
Well, this is a standard issue in lending between museums, that they always require more stringent climate control for the borrowing institution than the lending institution has in-house. Good.
And be fair on the vendor, too. I mean, if you're storing your audio materials in an air-conditioned warehouse, but you expect them to store them on-site with tightly controlled temperature and humidity, is that really realistic?
Fine by me.
And you should require the vendor to agree to the kind of documentation you'll require to describe how your media were handled during the project, something akin to a conservator's treatment plan. Again, this is the sort of thing where it may be necessary depending on what you're doing, the nature of the project, the importance of the materials, that sort of thing. It may not be necessary, and it will cost money, so factor that in.
So you may have a standardized way that you want to see across all your projects. We have a standardized way that we do it. So work with the vendor on seeing how that can most easily be achieved.
Next would be to describe the kind of periodic progress reporting you will require and how invoicing will be done. It might just be at the end if it's a small project, but there may be periodic progress payments, things like that.
And the schedule for payment really matters. I can tell you that it's gotten to be extremely painful right now. Payment terms are getting stretched out really, really far. You know what? If you get to be one of those institutions that's going to take you 90 or 120 days, you may just wait to get your materials processed, and that's a a simple matter of survival for the for vendors. There are very few AV vendors or of companies of any particular scale. It'd be really painful waiting to get paid. We just last Friday got paid on a $100,000 invoice. It was 109 days, and I got a call yesterday afternoon. The check bounced. This is a major university.
State a requirement to be allowed a visit to the vendor's site as part of your bid evaluation process. I think site visits are great. They tell you more than almost anything else. And if you happen to be, even if you're not considering reformatting or job at a particular time, and if you happen to be in a city where there's a vendor, I think it's always good. They always love to show off their shop and their equipment. You know, make it, because you'll have that information, you know, even if it's from a couple of years ago, you'll have visited them and talked to them, met some of their staff, things like that.
You know, the vendors like to do the tours and strut their stuff. You know, we give tours to anybody who's in Philadelphia when the conventions come through. You know, I was on the tour bus up to see PTLP when, was it MLA, was it in Pittsburgh?
I didn't get a to show up again.
Yeah, well, I know, I watched the book. I like the books and the getting dunked.
State a requirement to be allowed occasional inspection of the vendor's site during the work.
IBID.
Require the vendor to provide a list of clients for whom it has done similar work in the past. The list should include individuals' names, telephone numbers, and email addresses. You can use these contacts to reach other former clients of the vendor that may know in order to get their opinions as well.
Happens surprisingly infrequently. So I'm really amazed at how, for as many proposals as we send out, how infrequently we hear from our references that they're being checked. You know, nobody bats 1,000 as hard as we try. And it's interesting to in that review to find out what happened if there was a problem. If you're taking enough bids in, you may find that multiple vendors list the same reference. It'd be very interesting conversations to have if you look at those references and do your due diligence. That's part of your job.
And remember that reformatting is not a commodity. It's almost sometimes better to know how a vendor deals with curveballs than to get a reference that says they're great, they do everything right the first time. It just doesn't happen that way a lot of times, but how they deal with those exceptional circumstances.
It was a low bid, but everything was an exceptional circumstance and they made it up on the changes. All right, he's reminding us that our time is winding down.
Okay.
Here. We want to hustle through the rest of the slides if people have questions. Is this serving? Should we just keep going?
We've got selecting the vendor. This would be the point at which you've issued your RFP, and your vendors have given you their responses. The first step would be to determine, do the responses meet all the requirements of the RFP or the statement of work? If not, why not?
Could very well be that there's a flaw in the way the statement of work is written, that you've asked for something that was just way too specific.
Are the costs in line with your market survey? If not, why not, and are they justified?
And do you give the vendors a chance to respond to that?
How long has the vendor been business in doing this specific kind of work?
You know, the staff just come from another firm. You may end up with a lot of experience, even though the firm itself is very new to it. Or have they been doing related work?
Has the vendor substantiated that can do this type of work successfully?
Or do you want to take a flyer on a new vendor, which you know, may be very eager to do the work? And does your RFP provide for an out and or a performance bond? But if it's not going very well, either after the pilot or a couple of batches, have you written the RFP or the SOW in a way that you can pull the project?
How well-trained and experienced do you think its personnel are?
How can you tell?
That's hard. Are you satisfied with the equipment and its maintenance schedule?
Yeah. How do you know?
Will the vendor allow reference checks?
It helps have a prepared set of questions, and this is where it's front-running the slides here, you know, seek references listed by more than one vendor. Those are particularly interesting conversations.
And I would recommend making calls to your colleagues about experiences with vendors?
Nobody's going to put a bad reference on their list. So if you call around a little bit, you'll find somebody who's unhappy with somebody's work.
And again, it's how they deal with the curveballs, not whether they're a good or bad vendor, I think. I require the vendor to identify the applicable industry standards and state that it adheres to those industry standards.
So why are you asking the vendor to do that? Shouldn't that be in your statement of work about how you want the work to be done? And as a simple matter of fact, there are very few standards. You know, the ANSI standards calls for quarter-inch tape. Knock yourself out.
Yeah. Yeah, you can find a set of standards to justify pretty much everything, so. Does a vendor's site meet your needs for the security and safety of your materials?
How do you know? And how do they compare to your situation?
There's your site visit again. Are you satisfied with the proposed quality assurance program to ensure that the work product is as good as possible?
I'm just going to get on the soapbox again about how important it is to do quality assurance and to do it in a timely fashion. If I'd shipped materials off to a major university, 60, 90 days, they hadn't checked it, and then we get a call from a photographer trying to start. We had to teach them how to do QA on audio files. Great guy, smart, but has to teach them from scratch.
Is the vendor's financial history stable and the proposed financial arrangements with your institution acceptable? I mean, I guess they're defunct now, but so we can all, you know, you don't want your materials to end up in the dumpster because the, you know, whoever held the mortgage or whatever padlocked the building and things like that. And that did happen when Vitapex went out of business. Can I say that?
Yeah, just. And how are you going to evaluate financial history? We're a profitable company. We're struggling with cash flow right now. But any company worth its muster is going to be able to generate a P&L and a balance sheet and a couple of key clicks to be able to provide that. So I don't mind that. But let me tell you now, my institution's healthier than yours right now. And a major institution just bounced a $100,000 check on me. Call the bank.
Call my bank.
Does the vendor offer anything over and above the requirements of the request for proposal? Is it equitable for you to consider anything over and above the written requirements of the RFP when you're selecting the vendor? And if you do, could your contract award be legally challenged? And there may be things that are included sort of, you know, my institution, we're not doing MD5 checksums, for example. But vendors may routinely supply those with the things. I may not specify them in my RFP. But that's the kind of thing where, you know, it's a good thing to get, but if you don't specify it, it may come anyway. It may be part of the statement of work that the vendor supplies.
And if it's something that you like, give the other vendors an opportunity to bid on that part of it. It's something that you find attractive. A couple of years ago, I lost a job to John, where there was that wasn't even part of the project statement. How could I bid on that if that was I didn't know that there was something that you would like to have as part of it?
Based on a review of all the bids received, make a best value determination. Best value equals the best tech response plus an acceptable cost.
And what have you done to document your selection process? Is there just an excuse to use whoever you wanted, or the bid process been a cover? Remember, it costs money for the vendors to do that, and ultimately that drives up everybody's cost. And I don't mind providing you with a bid for something that you just need to put in front of your purchasing agent, and I know I'm going to be higher than somebody else. But don't pull the wool over my eyes. I can generate something in an hour as opposed to spending a week on it. We'll play ball.
Now we're on meta topic 4, which is managing the project. And this is our shortest section, although it's actually probably the most complex, but we're going to hit on some sort of major themes here in how that things you need to pay attention to make sure it doesn't go wrong. First off, your institution needs to decide who will be the point of contact for project management, file delivery, and any other contacts with the vendor. That could be one person, multiple people, but it's probably not the purchasing agent which issued the purchase order, and that may be the name that's on the purchase order. So that's the first step in communicating with the vendor in terms of who picks up the phone at each end when a question needs to be answered.
And sometimes this can be extremely bureaucratic in the federal government work. There's a contracting officer, and they're the only person that you can talk to, or they're on every conference call. But it's important in terms of processing the materials that there's somebody at the institution who owns the project, who knows what the specifications are, what the expectations are, if there's a deadline, and can hustle the project along if, you know, somebody needs to go get smacked up the side of the head to do their part in it. And it ultimately what we want is the project to run smoothly. We don't need somebody that we can hound. We just need somebody who is going to be responsive. And you want the same thing from us.
Second, at my institution, do you have all of your staff on board? I briefly touched on this before, but there could be a whole host of people that are required to get involved in order to get the project going and manage the project. It could be your IT staff, your metadata unit, people doing packing and shipping, which can be, as I've learned firsthand, can be much more time consuming than you'd ever imagine. And will I be able to deliver the media and the metadata on a promised schedule? You'd be surprised at how often those sorts of things slip behind.
You know, just in general, just have, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. You have, are your expectations of the vendor higher than what you can deliver yourself? You can get a lot of tension in a project, or it can be the magic that makes it run very smoothly.
Next step would be to ship or deliver your collection and metadata, and then wait for your return of tests, samples, pilot project, whatever you've chosen to call it. You want to get a small portion back and evaluate before, just because your RFP is perfect and your statement of work are perfect, doesn't mean that they can run the whole job and ship it back and it's going to be successful. So do allow for the return of tests, samples, pilot project, that sort of thing.
And be ready when they arrive. We're particularly hard ass about running pilot projects because there's so many changes or details that get worked out at that point that make running the rest of the project so much easier on both ends. So we really, really encourage pilot projects. And if that's what your takeaway from here and all the work that you do, that would be a really good one. It's amazing what you learn at that time.
And remember, getting the files at test batch back from the vendor is not to fulfill 3.2.1 of the RFP. This is your chance to evaluate the vendor's work and correct problems. And this is the point at which you need to be spending your time saying, is this what I want? Opening up the headers, actually looking at the metadata, whatever you need to do. This is where you spent your time on the RFP. This is where the rubber meets the road and you have to decide, are they up there? Can we make corrections? Because if you say, oh God, I'm so busy, I've got staff evaluations to do this week or something like that, and you blow it off, then you're going to lose. So
you might quite reasonably lose your spot in the queue.
So be prepared to spend some time when those files come back and evaluate them. Next, when you get those test files back, work with the vendor on any corrections, refinements, or changes to the process. And don't be afraid to ask questions. And ask, this is the kind of thing when you're working with your mechanic on your car or something like that. Don't be afraid of looking ignorant or whatever. If there's something you don't understand, ask until it's clarified to your satisfaction.
What is a mistake and what is a change? We see this fairly often where people get back something other than what they expected, although it happens to meet exactly what it is that they have in the document. If you weren't really working together and everybody's taking responsibility for their part of it, you know, I don't need to hold you up for a small change because we caught it in the pilot project and we'll just deal with it and go forward. It's the kind of thing that it may not affect our workflow, but if it changes everything that we've done, then that would be a charge. So just, you know, we all want to work together on these things.
Next step is go ahead and give the go-ahead to move the project into production.
And be clear of what your scheduling, your rotation of materials are. I said it's a big problem of your ability to ingest materials at the rate at which we can deliver them. And if there's a deadline and there's milestones, remember you're hustling to keep those dates going as well.
We did a project with George several years ago. And it was difficult for us to keep up. I mean, I was like, oh my God, I got another send another 8 or 10 boxes of tapes, you know, and it's taxing. So be prepared to meet those deadlines that you have agreed to keep as well. Wait for subsequent shipments of deliverables, whether that's CDs or files, hard drives, whatever. And continue to do further quality assurance testing on your end, making sure that the things haven't changed mid-project, that the process might need refining. Again, coming back to remember that reformatting services are not a commodity. I mean, we've all seen this where we have a run of materials, and the people making the original recordings could have used one thing for the first 1,000 tapes, and then a new person was hired or a new tape stock was chosen, and things change, and those things need to be taken into account. And you may not necessarily know that and may not necessarily have built that into the RFP, but when you get to that point where suddenly, oh, we didn't realize that something's changed here, something the engineers were originally doing, that's something that needs to be taken into account in the process.
And the way you process materials really doesn't scale. A QA process that works for a small project where you can really listen to everything and check everything probably won't work for a large project, but you don't want to spend the time programming a way to automate some of that for a small project. Our return rate is below 0.1%, but that's not 100%. And silly things happen in the middle of projects, like David was saying, that you know there's a screwball item in there. You know, just because everything you've received so far has been fine doesn't mean everything you will receive will be fine. We check every single deliverable before it ships. It doesn't mean we hit about 1,000. This is my soapbox. QA is not about a process of checking things at the end. It's about informing the process and fixing the source of the errors so they don't recur.
And that should really happen on the institution's end too, that it's a process. It's not a looking at the files when the hard drive comes back. It's a process that goes on throughout the project to make sure that the deliverables are what you expect.
It might reasonably be seen as double QA. We check it, you check it again.
But the more QA the vendor does, the easier the QA job is on your end. Finally, and this is the last slide, what is necessary to close the project? Return shipping, payment terms, okaying the vendor to delete the files from there. That's
the timer going off.
Pretty good timing, huh? Vendor deletion of work files, that sort of thing.
Oh, I can't wait to delete the files. If I get approvals in 30 days, I'm a happy camper. And all good project management entails a postmortem, whether you do that internally or you do it with the vendor. What did we learn from this? What went well? What can we do better the next time? How can we keep the problems from developing? We really enjoy the opportunity to work with an institution repeatedly because it allows you to work out these kinks in the system, and it gets easier and easier all the time.
I love working with vendors, actually. I learn a lot of what I learn about the job I do and what we are doing in-house is informed by working with vendors as well. So if you have the opportunity, I would encourage you to outsource things when possible. The things that scare archivists in terms of transporting materials off-site, things like that, I just don't think those are sorts of things that we should do it properly, but we shouldn't rule out this sort of thing because of those things that we're typically afraid of.
If they ship Da Vinci's and Vermeer's all over the world, there is a way of doing this. It's where we appeal to our related trades. In the museum community, they understand there's this phenomenon called an art shipper. And it's routine, but it's careful. In archives, the notion that anything would leave the building is scary. But museums, they're matter of fact about it. They take it seriously, but it's part of their culture and not part of ours, for instance.
So I think we've got about 20 minutes left, certainly for questions and answers. One of the things we had also mentioned was that we were going to try and take some time and say have a little vendor roundtable with respect to what things are helpful to vendors, but in lieu of that, since a couple, while we do have a number, if you're a vendor, raise your hand. I mean, we've got several in the room. And so given that we've got about 20 minutes left, I think it'd probably be a good idea if we just hit upon some Q&A from the audience. So somebody fire away. Yes, sir.
But there's nothing that somebody's going to be able to tell an engineer about a cassette ahead of time that's going to be useful other than that it's a cassette, so that they have a cassette machine in the room. But then the fact that it says Dolby on it doesn't mean that it actually does have it. All those points we're going to discover when we put it on and listen.
No, but if it says nothing, you can at least ask, you know, do you record these things Dolby or non-Dolby? If you do everything Dolby C, then...
But I don't think, from an archivist point of view, I don't think there'd be any point in putting all your cassettes on and trying to determine that in advance. Part of the point of sending them to the vendor is when the engineer puts in the cassette, they can figure out whether it's Dolby. It's not going to change the price of whether it's Dolby or not. But that's their, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it on my end.
Well, we see the cassette, we don't see the Dolby.
But you would also know how it sounds wrong if you've got the switch.
I mean, theoretically.
Theoretically.
Yeah, but I would need to know that it's a black shell and it's 8-inch tape.
You know, at some point, there's information. It could be high bias, so it could be 70 microseconds or 120 microseconds equalization. I mean, to just add another level of complexity.
The machine just add on that.
Usually. Yeah. Not every time. I mean, there was a record label, it might have been A&M, but one of them, for a long time, put out cassettes on Chrome. So I'm just saying, for every rule, there's an exception. But for the most part, you just kind of go by
what's written on the cassette. I've got a question for each of you, nuts and bolts for George. When you get a supply of tapes, do you typically want them with, say, scans or original materials, say, programs, track sheets to help ID and do metadata?
Well, generally, materials come to us that item level description, that work has been harvested by the institution. That's not always the case, but if you want us to do it, we're not going to charge you for it. But we really want that work to be done at the institution where they will have, somebody is a collection specialist and knows how to deal with this. It's really expensive to pay us to type. But if there is supporting documentation, that can be very useful.
Right.
A really good example are oral histories, which are classically not presented linearly on the tape. You know, you got the last 10 minutes of every tape is a different interview. Having access to transcripts in that case is very useful for piecing that stuff back together. Okay.
And then, David, I'm a fellow UC colleague, actually. What's your feeling in terms of trying to persuade a project manager that perhaps has no audio background whatsoever to go with a quality vendor as opposed to kind of a little mom and pop shop in the town that you live in that happens to claim to do audio transfers?
That's something we really didn't touch on, because there's really sort of two tiers of vendors. There's the sort of the Georgia Blood operations, and then in Santa Barbara where I am, there's the person down the street that can copy open reels and that sort of thing. And I don't want to say buyer beware necessarily on some of those, because they have a useful function. But if your specifications are at any sort of level of your technical requirements, and it doesn't have anything to do with their competence in terms of playing back, I mean, that's variable too, but if you have certain expectations of what kind of metadata you're going to get back,
I'm speaking of the audio content, though, not the metadata.
It's all a package, and what is the scope of work?
But if you need a Mets record back with your thing, local vendors aren't going to work. But we use, I don't want to get into film, but I mean, for film, you have a tiered system as well of, and we use people at different levels for that sort of process. And I think it's appropriate sometimes if you just need, you've got five tapes and you need a patron dubs and it's a format you can't do, but you need to provide access copies, send them to your local guy and don't spend, you know, don't get in George's 15-month queue or whatever it is, you know. I think they're both appropriate, but I think this presentation focused more on, you know, a large-scale project where you hire that sort of, you know, vendor who specializes in large projects for archives and libraries.
I just wanted to also add to that, I tend to be wary of vendors with price lists. Because if you're a vendor with a price list and you're assuming that you can do a transfer at a fixed rate every time, then you're really not addressing a lot of things that both David and George raised in their presentation, because you cannot make assumptions. Certainly for small batch things, again, that might be appropriate. But I think when you look at someone that has a very static price list, then you have to wonder, you know, with the dynamics of the project, can they still adhere to that? I have one project where it was 3,000 hours of DATs. It was bid at $7,500. That's $250 an hour for those who are quick with math. And I don't know how anybody, I mean, I can make more money being a fry master. So, Steve, I think you're next.
Yeah, there's actually an in-between tier. I don't know how this, an in-between tier of the small professional vendor, and I'm only 5'7".
But not middling.
But who have, you know, the usual skills, let's say. But I've run into a couple of problems which are probably more related to the small guy, or I'm a one-man operation with a guy who comes in to empty the waste baskets. Now, I find two problems that are related to this directly. One is you get an RFP and it says, regardless, you do the paperwork and so forth, and they say, and you will, if this is awarded, you will fulfill this RFP. Now, you may have five of those things pending, and you know, you need at least 2 hours sleep a night. So there's a certain, there's no obligation on the other side of this. And that is really a difficult piece of paper to sign your life away on. In conjunction with that, is something George brought up, but is since I can't scale up the way George can, I get people who say, okay, this is a job that's right up your alley and we want it back in a year and 5 months or something like that. And yes, I can do it in a year and 5 months, but I do need those 2 hours sleep. And they're simply unrealistic for a small detail shop to do. And I'm bringing up the issue rather than proposing a solution. And I don't know whether this is the kind of thing that, it's more to make the people who are the potential.
Well, it's like if you're working on your house, you know, to have a handyman come in and, you know, redo the tile in your bathroom, you don't have to hire a construction company that can put up, you know, 50 houses a day. But there's a very good reason to hire somebody, and certainly somebody like Steve, who's got such a wealth of experience. And, you know, you, eating up on me on what I can scale up to, you know, 20 years ago, it was just me. And, you know, it took a while, you know, for me to get to that point where we had enough experience and enough work to scale up. But there's a place for the small vendors as well as the large ones. It's really hard and expensive for us to do one-offs. And we do them, particularly around the holidays, and we're happy to do them. But, you know, it's a real strain given the amount of overhead we have to do those kinds of things.
I'd like to address Steve's point as well, because I think he raises something valid. And this, you know, this came from originally from Alan Lewis's presentation that he did with George, which was really largely based around sort of government contracting types of things. And as a curator of your collection at your institution, it is important to remember the sort of the universe of vendors out there. pick somebody because he's not here, but let's say you've got wire recordings. You know, everybody would know that, that somebody like Art Schifrin has is would be able to do those. Probably, can I say better than George Blood?
At least as well as.
I would say, yeah. You know, but if you write, and Art is a
He's made it a specialty.
It's a specialty. But if you write a RFP that's so freaking complicated and, you know, requires performance bonds and lines of credit and things like that, your Art's not going to bid on your job, and you're going to probably lose out on hiring the best possible vendor for that job.
Well,
so,
I object to the characterization.
Of Art or of the...
Because
you're... Well, I didn't mean to get into discussion of who does wires best, but my point is that there are, small and boutique vendors that are specialized in certain sorts of things and can work magic like Doug Pomery did with the savory acetates and things like that, that it's always important to keep the whole picture in mind.
I just wanted to bring an extra perspective to the conversation. I'm from the National Endowment for the Humanities, and mostly I just wanted to emphasize that the advice that David and George are giving are very sound from a funder's perspective. We do closely look at the type of relationship that's being drawn between an outside vendor and the institution, and it does fall under scrutiny, and the kinds of things that were brought up during this presentation are absolutely essential to the review process. So I don't want to sort of take up any more time in the Q&A, but if anyone has any questions sort of regarding, you know, these types of topics from a funder's perspective, I'm happy to talk to anyone after the session, or I'll be here the rest of the conference. So thank you.
This workshop has been really outstanding. I've learned a lot about planning projects like this. So if in your institution, when you're planning a writing an RFP like this, if you're not really empowered to build in contingencies, how do you sort of build them in without calling them contingencies or thinking, how do you think about them in other terms?
If you're writing a new RFP, mm-hmm. Call your colleagues and grab half a dozen of them. Or I'll send you half a dozen RFPs.
But I would prefer not a cut and paste job of the six.
Well, yeah. You have to be informed about the way you did it. But I did have an Ivy League institution call me about, you know, we're doing this. Can you send us some RFPs? And I marked them up, said, this is dumb. This is really useful. And, you know, what they wrote up was pretty good. But they had experience with working with vendors, but they were interested to get that feedback from us about what works and what doesn't work.
I'm a vendor, I guess, so I wanted to talk about the notion of RFPs. And one of the things that had been talked about is this notion about, you know, be careful how you send the RFP if you're just going to send it to someone and you maybe have a favorite vendor you're looking at. But my perspective on that is a little bit different, and I wanted to be real clear about that. As a vendor, I feel worse if I don't find out about an RFP than if I found out later I didn't get it. And so I sort of take the approach of, you know, you will not know what a great dancer and what a dinner companion I am unless I get a chance to take you to the prom. And so I mean, so unless it's totally frivolous, by all means, abuse us. We have staff and we have writing. It's part of our budget to do this work, and it's part of our education process. So I don't think you should be too concerned about sending something to me and then telling me later I've chosen someone else. Maybe by the third time I'll show you how wonderful I am.
Now, I want a chance to be the vendor that has the $17,000 bid against an $87,000.
Well, and you do look good in a strapless gown.
Maybe next time you'll be a $40,000 job and you'll all come out in the middle.
I have a question. What if you're, just as a kind of a case study, so what if you're an institution, you've got some audio materials, you have nobody on campus who has any experience in dealing with these, they've just been sitting on the shelf. So how does the process of like doing something like a collection survey happen? Is this something that should be left up to the vendor, or
no.
or is this something that the institution should hire a consultant to do, or how should this work?
Let me see if I understand the question. So the question is, should the institution be doing, sort of have an understanding of the content of the collection, or should it be handed off to the vendor to conduct that? Or
they may be able to look at, like, say, the labels on the boxes and
right.
the real tapes and say, okay, this is what this is.
Yeah. I see.
John.
So, yeah. Right. Gotcha. Well, this we have sort of a couple of tiers to our programs. If you're looking to get a sort of a baseline kind of assessment of the collection, issues like sticky shed and you know what processes are going to need to happen to help preserve the collection. You can go at a very baseline kind of program like our preservation assistance grants for smaller institutions. And that's just a basic $6,000 max to hire a consultant to come in, and they can conduct the kind of initial assessment. And you know, the sort of the complementary programs through IMLS is, you know, the CAPS and the MAPS and that sort of thing. So, you know, so we sort of populate at that level. And if you're going to really want to preserve that collection and you know digitize it or do a much more thorough kind of arrangement and description, then it gets a little tricky because we expect kind of a level of knowledge about the collection that's upfront, because that's our way of assessing or reviewing the, you know, the strength of the application is do they know what they have. We get applications all the time with AV collections that say, well, you know, we don't have the equipment to listen to it, but we think we know what's on it. And so it puts us in an awkward position, and David's been a reviewer for us, and you know, there's just nothing to review if we don't know what's on the collections, so or what's on the actual media. So it's a tricky situation, so my advice would be, if you need sort of a basic assessment to get the ball rolling, you know, think smaller. But if you do come for us to us for kind of a higher level grant, then you do need to do some of the legwork ahead of time. Otherwise, we don't know whether the collection is significant or not.
And those assessment grants,
yeah. Less paperwork. Yeah, and the higher rate of return too. So the you know, it's less risk. And
Josh, what percentage of those PAGs do you? It's pretty
PAGs
high.
PAGs are about 40% to 50%, they're smaller grants in terms of preparation, and I think I don't know the maximum page limit is. It's somewhere 5 to 7 pages. So you still need to have some sense of what's in the collections, but we understand that you know part of starting the preservation work is to go out and get that initial assessment, especially if you don't have the training involved. And that's another aspect of that same program is you can go and you know 4-year institution get the training to you know basic handling procedures for AV collections. So, so sort of the combination of training versus assessment, you know, we feel you know. You know, sort of gets the you know, gets the process moving, and then people can move up to the higher level programs after that, and they quite often do once they receive a PAG.
I just wanted to kind of connect some dots on this as well and point out the value of a pilot project, not only for figuring out how to do work, but also to start exploring collections that are under-documented, and of course with audio and video, we have the classic chicken egg problem of we believe there's something important on the collection, but until we play back the collection, we won't know just how important. And if we're going to play back the collection, we may as well do a preservation transfer. I think this is an area where NEH actually has the right model already in its infrastructure programs, where in that case, there's a planning grant phase that funds initial work and development of infrastructure plans with an architect, and then makes one eligible for an application for a much larger, the stabilizing humanities collections. It would be very interesting to see that model roll out for audio, video, and even some digital collections where we have obsolescence issues.
Of our preservation sort of environment or set of programs, which is, as you mentioned, the Sustaining Cultural Heritage Collections program, which is geared much more towards the infrastructure of your facilities. And I just want to emphasize overall that we have a heightened interest in preserving audiovisual collections. It's why I'm here. It's why we usually send Charlie Kolb here. A lot of you might know him from the past. And so we've tried to integrate that into all of our programs, R&D, which isn't really relevant for this discussion. But in terms of the SEHC, absolutely. There are two levels. The planning level, which is to hire an interdisciplinary team of both technicians, architects, engineers, facility managers, archivists, whomever you think needs to be involved in the process of getting the environmental settings correct, getting the HVAC systems, the fire suppression, on and on and on. And then again, the next level of that is an implementation level. So we do really hope to see AV institutions apply to us so that we can begin to disseminate some of that knowledge to the rest of the community, especially for the planning grants, which require a white paper at the end, which we then want to be able to have accessible to everyone so they can use as a reference model.
Okay, well, that about, we are actually about 1 to 2 minutes past time. I got one more question if there's not, let's give our panelists a round of applause and thank you for your time.